Hello and welcome to Science World. So far, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has claimed hundreds of lives and infected even many more. We'll hear that as cases of this deadly disease continue to grow, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as other international health agencies, are working hard to reduce the spread of the infection. Officials with the European Space Agency say its Rosetta spacecraft will soon reach the comet it has been chasing for the past 10 years. And we'll hear what the space agency is hoping to learn from its up-close study and its hoped-for landing on the comet. And in another part of our solar system, the Curiosity rover on Mars has been sending back data that suggests a very interesting geologic past. We'll talk with one of the scientists about a time when Mars was much warmer and wetter than it is today, and how it may have at one time even been habitable. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has so far claimed hundreds of lives and has infected many more people. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says more cases can be expected in the coming weeks and months. As Carol Pearson reports, the health agency is actively trying to stem the spread of the infection.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, downplays concerns that the Ebola virus could spread in the U.S. because of the practices already in place in most U.S. hospitals. Two American healthcare workers in Africa have contracted the disease. In the past, the strain of Ebola that's circulating in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia has killed 90% of those who got sick. The CDC says the death rate for the current outbreak is around 60%, a figure experts claim shows that early treatment is having an impact. Experts from the CDC are in West Africa, where they're working with the ministries of health and international health organizations to keep track of the outbreak and coordinate resources to deal with it. The CDC's Stephen Monroe monitors emerging diseases. He spoke during a teleconference from the CDC's headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia.
We know how to stop the outbreak, and that is to break the chains of transmission. And so what does that involve? It involves first identifying cases through active case finding, and then identifying all of their contacts who had contact with them during the time they were symptomatic and therefore are at risk of becoming infected themselves, and following those contacts daily for 21 days, and if they do develop symptoms, to get them into one of these isolation facilities.
Monroe says fear and misinformation are major factors in preventing people from seeking treatment. He said what the CDC and health organizations are trying to do is find trusted members of the affected communities to get the word out about how to contain the disease. There are no specific drugs to treat Ebola. What healthcare workers can do is provide fluids and treat the early symptoms, which include high fever, muscle aches, vomiting, and diarrhea. The symptoms could also be mistaken for influenza or malaria, and unless patients are isolated and caregivers avoid contact with the patient's blood, saliva, or other bodily fluids, the disease can spread. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
New proposed rules to cut pollution from the 600 coal-fired power plants here in the United States are generating a heated debate. As Roseanne Skirbel reports, those on both sides of the issue are also making sure that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency knows just how they feel about these proposed new rules.
West Virginia native Regina Hendricks came to Washington to demand limits on coal plant emissions. In her state, she's seen mountaintops removed, waterways polluted, and air fouled because of coal operations.
And these sites belch out mercury, selenium, and poison, some of them in perpetuity.
Hendricks is fed up. So are West Virginia chemist Pamela Ellis and her twin daughters, Anya and Sephora, who join ranks outside EPA headquarters to support the EPA plan to cut carbon pollution.
If we don't do it now, in the next 15 years, we will have consequences where we will not be able to be a sustainable planet. And so that's why we left West Virginia on a bus with other supporters. And we're all here. We're excited about change. And we're going to hold people accountable.
Coal-fired power plants supply nearly 40% of the nation's electricity. These plants are also the largest source of carbon pollution. The EPA plan mandates a 30% cut in carbon emissions below 2005 levels through a broad array of actions, from energy efficiency to renewable energy options. Like the others who filed into EPA headquarters throughout the day, Jeff Homestead waited patiently for his turn to testify. The former EPA official represents the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council, a trade group that opposes the proposed rule on the grounds that it would shut plants, eliminate jobs, and raise electric rates.
Hello, my name is Jeff Homestead, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council. First, I do think it is important that we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but I think we also need to be honest about what that means. There is no free lunch, and it will increase the cost of power. We just need to decide as a society how much we want to pay for that.
But it's not just about money. Homestead told the EPA panel that Americans would end up sacrificing an electric system they depend on. He added that the plan would also seriously delay curbing climate-changing emissions. 9 states have already joined in a lawsuit to oppose the measure. The new rule is expected to be finalized by next June. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
There is bad news and good news in the fight against malaria. First, the bad news. Research indicates drug-resistant malaria is spreading across Southeast Asia. The good news? A new anti-malarial drug looks promising in an early test. Steve Barragona reports.
From Vietnam to Burma, the leading drug against malaria is losing potency, according to a new study in the New England Journal of Medicine. Artemisinin-based drugs have helped public health workers make dramatic gains against malaria worldwide, so the rise of resistance is very worrying, says Dr. Chris Plow at the University of Maryland School of Medicine.
There's nothing on the shelf that's ready to replace those, so if we lose this class of drugs, it's really going to be a global health catastrophe.
He and his colleagues studied resistance rates in 7 Asian and 3 African countries. The worst problems were along the Thailand-Cambodia border, but they found significant resistance from southern Vietnam to central Burma. That's bad news, says Columbia University microbiologist David Fiddock, who is not involved in the research.
So what this paper shows is that it's moved beyond the original confine, which was in western Cambodia, and has now spread across Southeast Asia. So that speaks to the possibility that, you know, from there it can jump into Africa, which is the big concern ultimately.
That's what happened with resistance to previous malaria drugs, and it cost countless lives. In fact, Plow says, this part of the world has proved to be a drug-resistant malaria hotspot.
Yeah, it's happened again and again, at least with 4 different anti-malarial drugs that we know of now, where resistant parasites popped up first along the border between Thailand and Cambodia.
It's not clear why. Scientists are trying to figure that out. The good news is, Plow's group did not find resistance in Africa yet. And he says the drugs take longer to work, but they still do. For now.
We don't have very much time with the artemisinins based on the rate at which resistance appears to be emerging and spreading.
In another study in the same issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, a new drug quickly rid 21 patients of malaria parasites. It's called spiroindolone, and it's made by the pharmaceutical company Novartis. It's on track to be the first to take over when the artemisinin drugs fail. But Plow is cautious.
Because it's very early days, this was a very small study, the initial news is pretty good.
Fiddock notes, however, that the drug has a known weakness.
That target can mutate fairly readily. So we know that it's already, to some degree, susceptible to resistance.
Spiroindolone would be combined with at least one other drug to slow down resistance. And Fiddock notes there are other drugs racing to be ready for the day when artemisinin fails. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Although NASA's Curiosity Mars rover has been getting the lion's share of attention lately, another one of its rovers sent there years earlier established a new distance record this week. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, what is the name of that record-setting rover? Is it A, Viking, B, Spirit, or C, Opportunity? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
The Science and Technology Park at Kenya's University of Nairobi is banking on 3D prototyping to spark a manufacturing revolution in the country. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more about Nairobi's so-called Fab Lab.
The 3D MakerBot printer is a unique piece of technology. The machine is a scanner that also prints three-dimensional objects of almost any shape from electronic data. But instead of printing on paper, as regular printers do, this machine uses plastic as its raw material, which is something that drastically reduces costs in the manufacture of various products. Alois Mbutura is a first-year electrical engineering student at the University of Nairobi. Back this past March, he came up with the idea of a vein finder. That's a device that will help doctors administer intravenous needles to tiny infants. Today, he's perfecting his design that's currently in the prototype phase of development. The 3D MakerBot printer is able to produce 100 such devices in a single day.
The vein finder was actually a solution that was actually wanted to, that the School of Health and the School of Engineering partnered with, so as to reduce the inability of healthcare people to find veins in babies, and also for it to be actually economical and suited to Kenya.
This so-called Fab Lab is a small-scale workshop that offers digital fabrication at the University of Nairobi. It's part of the International Fab Lab Network, which started at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Kamau Gashigi heads the Fab Lab in Nairobi. Established 5 years ago, its initial aim was to make, quote, almost anything. There are some 400 of these Fab Labs throughout the world now, including two in Kenya. Dr. Gashigi believes they will promote the creation of an atmosphere and culture of innovation.
The maker movement will generate a new kind of producer, so to speak, and a lot of young people are extremely interested. Young people nowadays just have a knack for technology.
And this so-called maker movement is gradually beginning to take shape. 2 years ago, Peter Mburi won the People's Choice Award at the NASA Space Applications Challenge for his bit harvester invention, made possible by this 3D technology.
Bit harvester is an electronic device that's designed to monitor remotely using SMS wind turbines and solar installations. So you can see if they're operating okay or they're not operating okay, and you can take the necessary measures to see how to correct the problem.
In a few months, a third Kenyan Fab Lab is scheduled to open on the outskirts of Nairobi. It's expected to focus on medical and energy-based equipment, taking this manufacturing revolution to another level. For Lenny Ruvaga, I'm Doug Bernard.
After a long flight through deep space, a European Space Agency probe is finally approaching its target, a comet millions of kilometers away from Earth. Scientists say the mission may lead to some startling discoveries about the origins of water on Earth. George Putich has more.
10 years ago, a European Space Agency rocket took off with a spacecraft called Rosetta on a mission to perform the most detailed study of a comet. While asteroids are large rocks, almost like small planets, comets are mostly made of ice, says Ralph Cordy, the business manager for Airbus Defence and Space, which built the Rosetta spacecraft.
We know today that our Earth has a great deal of water on it. We don't know exactly where it came from, and it's likely that comets had a lot to do with that process.
It took more than 10 years for Rosetta to make 3 swings around Earth and 1 around Mars, gathering enough speed to reach the comet named 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, 400,000 kilometers from Earth. For the last 2.5 years, many of its onboard systems were in the sleep mode to save energy, says Airbus engineer Simon Baraclough.
So we're close to the sun, a lot of things are on. When we're further from the sun, a lot of things are off.
A wake-up call in January brought cheers in the mission headquarters in Darmstadt, Germany, as a signal from Rosetta indicated that its computer was wide awake again. The spacecraft will soon start orbiting the comet at a distance of about 10 kilometers, taking measurements and mapping its surface. In November, it is scheduled to release a smaller probe called Philae, which will land on the comet. Cordy says both Rosetta and Philae will measure the comet's gas and dust and send pictures of its surface.
It will also have a very nice radar system on board it, which will communicate with the orbiting spacecraft, the mothercraft, and use the radar signals to probe the heart of the comet's nucleus. So it's not just looking at the surface or the environment around it, it's actually going to be probing what's underneath the surface.
The probes will travel with the comet for a full year. Rosetta will continue measuring how the comet changes as it approaches the sun and starts to warm up, while Philae will analyze samples of its surface and subsurface. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
It's time to find out if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. One of NASA's Mars rovers set a new distance record this past week. We wanted to know the name of the record setter. Is it A, Viking, B, Spirit, or C, Opportunity? The answer is C. This past week, the Mars rover Opportunity set a new off-Earth roving distance record after traveling across 40.25 kilometers of Martian landscape. Opportunity began its roving mission after touching down on Mars in January 2004. The previous record holder was the Soviet Union's Lunokhod 2 rover, which in 1973 traveled a total of about 39 kilometers across the moon. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Geologist Gregory Ratalik, who is also a professor at the University of Oregon, was looking at some images of the landscape surrounding Mars Gale Crater that was taken by the Mars rover Curiosity. Professor Ratalik noticed that those images revealed what appeared to be Earth-like soil profiles that reminded him of the soils found in Earth's Antarctic dry valleys and Chile's Atacama Desert. So, along with those images, the professor also began his study of mineral and chemical data that was also sent back from Mars by Curiosity. The images and data revealed that the soil he was studying dated back to some 3.7 billion years ago, providing him with evidence that Mars was once a long time ago a much warmer and wetter planet. Ratalik says that scientists conducting similar research on Earth's geological history haven't been able to reach as far back in time as he was able to do with his Mars study, because unlike the Red Planet, Earth's oldest soil was destroyed over the years by plate tectonics. Professor Ratalik joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about his research that provided him with evidence that several billion years ago, Mars may have actually been habitable. What first led you to look into some of the soil history of Mars?
I just sort of was really taken by some of the images that were coming back. They looked like buried soils, which is my specialty. And seeing is believing, of course, but they parked at this outcrop where I thought the buried soil was, and they drilled holes in it, and they made analyses, and when the data came in, we have ways of presenting that data that just nailed it, and it was really kind of thrilling for me. The team that was working with the rover didn't recognize it as a paleosol. They dismissed that interpretation, and they didn't discuss it in their published paper. And I was a bit miffed by that at first, but then I realized, oh my goodness, now that they've published all the data, they've given me this fantastic gift.
Paleosol. You mentioned paleosol. What is that?
A paleosol is a buried soil. So it's a soil that formed at some time in the past, and then it was covered up by sediment, like a flood deposit or a landslide or a lava flow. And then it pretty much is a part of the rock record from then on. We can use those soils to interpret what environments were like in the distant geological past.
How did Curiosity's data and imagery reveal the evidence you were looking for that Mars was warmer and wetter early in its history?
Well, what it showed very clearly was that the most common kind of weathering reaction we have on Earth, which is called hydrolysis, where you make clay out of feldspar and olivine, actually happened on Mars as well.
You also drew a comparison of Mars soil with that found at Earth's Antarctic dry valleys in Chile's Atacama Desert. Could you explain that?
There are lots of different sorts of fossil soils on Earth and lots of different modern soils, and we know quite a bit of how soils form. The soil that we found on Mars, buried in this 3.7 billion year old crater, are very shallow, and they're full of a mineral called gypsum, which is the material we make plaster of Paris and drywall from. And these sorts of soils are best known on Earth from extremely arid or cold environments like the dry valleys of Antarctica and the Atacama Desert. It's a very low productivity environment with only a few very, very hardy kinds of microbes. So if these Martian soils were alive, they were barely puttering along like they do in some of the most barren places on Earth.
You draw sort of a comparison, and I guess it must have been interesting to study and compare the various layers of Martian soil and rock with the new samples that are quite different than the older layers deep beneath it. Could you provide us a bit of a comparison between what we see in the newer rocks and soil samples on Mars versus the much older samples?
Yeah, the Viking landers of 1976, remember them?
Mm-hmm.
Carl Sagan was involved in them. It seems like such a long time ago. We had quite good images, and we scooped around those landers, and we have a bit of an idea about what the soil is like in those spots. Those soils were very interesting indeed, because they're about 3 billion years old, not 3.7 or so, and those soils are very old themselves. Even though they're at the surface, those soils have so much clay and so much alteration in them that we don't think that they could form on Mars as it is currently. We think that those are fossil soils in the sense that they are relict, that they are remaining from soil-forming conditions that no longer exist. And this suggests that sometime between about 3.7 and 3 billion years, Mars, if it was ever alive, was dying and drying and getting colder with the development of the current cold climate on Mars.
You indicate in your research that, again, Mars was much warmer and wetter back in 3.7 billion years ago. How warm, how wet was the planet?
Well, at 3.7, we see Mars as being something like Greenland or Antarctica. But that's a lot warmer than it is now.
While your studies didn't really conclude that Mars may have once contained life, the environmental conditions suggested by your findings do indicate that the red planet was more habitable than the planet it has been in the past 3 billion years.
Exactly. And we also think that it's possible that there are even more habitable soils in some of the older terrains on Mars, which we're considering for future missions. Now, we want to know, for example, how long it took the planet to become from barely habitable, which is how I would describe the fossil soil that I was working on, to pretty inhospitable. And so that'll be interesting. We'll find out quite a bit more about that, I think, as the months go on.
That was Dr. Gregory Ratalik, a geologist and professor at the University of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology
on Science World.